For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging. In Australia, about 700,000 people have resistant hypertension. That is high blood pressure that remains uncontrolled despite adherence to three or more different antihypertensive drug classes, including a diuretic at maximally tolerated doses. Given that hypertension alone is responsible for 43% of coronary heart disease, 41% of stroke, 38% of chronic kidney disease, and 32% of atrial fibrillation, it's easy to see that there is plenty of incentive for research into new treatments, particularly for resistant hypertension.
I think the beauty is we have really tried as hard as you can to ensure that traditional medications didn't quite do the job. Yet, on top of that, with this new drug, we saw significant and clinically relevant blood pressure lowering. So that's really a bit of a game changer.
That was Professor Marcus Sleich, the Dobney Chair in Clinical Research at the University of Western Australia and Director of the Dobney Hypertension Centre in Perth. Marcus is a co-author of a phase 3 trial published recently in The Lancet, which found a new class of drug, a dual endothelin antagonist called aprocitentan, was superior to placebo and well tolerated while lowering blood pressure in patients with resistant hypertension. It's an exciting development, and I'm delighted to have Marcus as my special guest today. You've just published in The Lancet on a particular treatment for resistant hypertension, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about resistant hypertension. What is the definition of it?
So resistant hypertension is usually defined if a person is on three or more blood pressure lowering medications, including a diuretic, because fluid retention is a common feature, and ideally at maximally tolerated doses. So if they fulfill those criteria and their blood pressure remains above the target level, This then fulfills the criteria of resistant hypertension. If we use office blood pressure readings as usually done in a GP setting, it would be 140 over 90.
What is the mechanism behind the resistance? What turns hypertension into resistant hypertension? Do we know?
Well, there's a number of factors. We know the characteristics of this population. Often it's elderly patients who tend to have stiffer arteries. Often it's patients who also have other concomitant conditions such as diabetes, high cholesterol. A very common feature is overweight and obesity. So if we look across all the studies in that space, usually the body mass index, which is one measure of obesity, is in the mid-30s. So they have mild to moderate obesity. And very frequently also some form of chronic kidney disease. You know, these conditions also trigger and activate a number of pathophysiologically relevant mechanisms that then make it quite hard for the traditional drugs to bring blood pressure to target. And this is where we kind of need newer approaches, I guess.
So what are the consequences of resistant hypertension on long-term health?
Hypertension in its own right is known to be, you know, the silent killer. It is responsible for the majority of strokes, heart attacks, heart failure, kidney failure. And this is further exaggerated in patients who have so-called resistant hypertension. So their risk is, you know, another four times higher than if you just have a high blood pressure, you know, which does not qualify for resistance. So the high risk population, and often they're really waiting for their strokes to happen.
Do we know what the incidence is in Australia?
There's international studies, but also Australian studies. On average, around a third of the adult population in most westernized countries and other and developing countries for that matter have high blood pressure. And of those, around 10 to 12% of patients fulfill the criteria of resistant hypertension if you use very stringent blood pressure measurements. So if you cut that down to Australian circumstances, let's say if we have roughly 20 million adults, you know, a third of those, six and a half million, have high blood pressure, and 10 to 12% have resistant hypertension. We're talking around 650,000, 750,000 Australians with that condition.
And I can imagine if that goes untreated, the cost to the health system as those people have their strokes and their heart attacks is really quite enormous.
Indeed. And again, we've got good data. The most important or the most cost intense conditions are obviously stroke, renal failure if patients require dialysis, which is, of course, more common. So aside, of course, from the drama it causes for the individual and their families, the cost to the economy and to the community at large is huge. Significant burden indeed.
So let's talk a little bit about the endothelin pathway. Am I pronouncing that right, by the way?
Endothelin
pathway. Okay. What is the endothelin pathway and what does it have to do with resistant hypertension?
Yeah, excellent point. So most of the drugs we use, they target specific pathways. And the most commonly used is the so-called renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. And the drugs we have there, such as ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, are terrific drugs. They're considered first-line choices. We have other drugs like calcium channel blockers that, as the word says, block the calcium channel and thereby restrict them from constricting. We have diuretics, which help to get rid of excess fluid. So the concept of dealing with high blood pressure is to target or use drugs and combine drugs which have a different mode of action. But unfortunately, even if you combine these three best drugs we have in, again, 10 to 12% of patients with high blood pressure, it doesn't work. It doesn't bring the blood pressure down. So this brought us to look at other relevant mechanisms. And this is where this endothelin pathway fits in. Endothelin is a molecule produced by the body, and it's one of the most potent vasoconstrictors. So once it is released, it results in a significant constriction of the blood vessel. And of course, in a closed system, constriction of the vessel will mean the pressure goes up substantially. And by blocking the receptors to which this endothelin binds in order to constrict the vessels, we get a blood pressure lowering and a relaxation of those vessels. Okay. And the reason why we believe it's working is because none of the other drugs available at this stage target this system. So it's essentially unopposed. And given that the other three don't work as much as they should, it is logical that there's another mechanism in play, and that's, you know, the endothelin pathway.
So your research that you've just published is basically saying, let's block endothelin and see what that does.
That is exactly the theory behind it. If you have someone and you throw the best drugs you have at the person and it's still not working, well, there must be another component which has been overlooked. And based on the results we had in this phase 3 study, the endothelin pathway is a very obvious candidate for that, and it seems to work quite efficiently.
Okay, we'll get to your study in a minute. Is endothelin a relatively new discovery? Is the pathway a new thing, or why hasn't it been targeted before?
No, it's not. We knew about endothelin for a long time, and in fact, there have been efforts to target this system before, but it is a bit tricky to target, and there have been attempts which failed previously.
Right.
It hasn't been really out in the wider press, but you know, hypertension specialists would know about the pathway. They would know about endothelin, but it was just difficult with pharmacological approaches to target that appropriately. But this is what seems to have worked now with this specific compound, which is a so-called dual endothelin antagonist and blocks both the receptors this molecule uses. And that's probably the secret why it works.
Apart from blocking the receptors, is there a way of stopping endothelin from being released in the first place?
Not really. So, you know, the endothelin, as a lot of the other active molecules, they are produced by the body. And it's a common pharmacological principle that you essentially, it's easier to block the receptor. It's much easier to create and generate drugs that can block a receptor rather than trying to target the circulating molecule, which can escape via various routes. So, you know, we have beta blockers. We've got these calcium channel blockers. They all have a very similar principle of working, namely blocking the receptor. You don't really affect the molecule as such, but you prevent it from binding to its receptor, therefore inhibit its action.
So tell us about the specific therapy you were looking at in this study.
So this was a very sophisticated study, a so-called phase 3 study. And it is not easy to study patients with resistant hypertension because they are on 4, 5, 6 different drugs already. Nothing seems to work appropriately. Patients are not always adherent with their prescribed medication. That's something you have to check first. So we had a very long run in phase for this trial to make sure that people are actually taking their meds. We put all patients from their individual background therapy, which their GPs or other specialists may have implemented, on a standardized single pill combination, including three drugs in a single pill. The reason is that we know this improves adherence with medication. It is more effective. So we wanted to give them the best chance with the known drugs to lower their blood pressure. Quite a few people, you know, then reached target. So we had a few people who didn't qualify anymore once we did that. There was still 730 patients whose blood pressure remained uncontrolled. And they were then randomized after this 12-week run-in phase to either placebo or two different doses of this new drug called aprocitentan, this endothelin antagonist. And we had a 4-week double-blind phase at the end of which the primary endpoint was assessed. So the difference in blood pressure within those 4 weeks. That wasn't enough. We also wanted to make sure this drug is tolerated well and acts in the long term, because blood pressure management is not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Absolutely.
We want to make sure that people's blood pressure is controlled, you know, essentially for the rest of their lives. So a drug that is not well tolerated that works, but you know, people will get off it after a few weeks is useless. So we need long-term data. And that was the second part of this study. For 32 weeks, all patients were put on the active drug. And then at the end, to prove again that the blood pressure lowering was caused by this new drug, we had a withdrawal phase where people were re-randomized. Everybody was on the drug, but then half of them were randomized back to placebo. And what we saw is, again, the blood pressure went up again significantly, proving really that all the effects we had seen were clearly due to this new medication.
I'm chatting today with Professor Marcus Schleich, Director of the Dobney Hypertension Centre in Perth. Marcus's co-authored research on aprocitentan is published at The Lancet, and the link to the study is available in the show notes for this podcast. Marcus has also written an op-ed for Insight Plus to accompany this podcast, and you will find the link to that article also in the show notes. If you're enjoying this episode, you can find our back catalogue of podcasts at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all freely available. To subscribe to our upcoming episodes, search for the Medical Journal of Australia on your favourite podcast platform and hit the subscribe button. It's free. Back to our chat. Any adverse events?
Yes. So as with all medications, there can be side effects, adverse events. In the context of this drug class, endothelin antagonists, fluid retention edema is known to occur. And this did occur. And roughly, it is a bit of a dose-dependent side effect. So the higher the dose, the more likely. On the lower dose, around 9% of patients had ankle swelling, you know, peripheral edema, as we call it. Yep. In the higher dose, it was essentially doubled, around 18%. So, you know, that's a reasonable number. However, this fluid retention almost uniformly occurs in the first 4 weeks. It responds very well to additional diuretic therapy.
Okay.
If it is an issue in those 18%, for example, it is easily manageable by increasing or adding a diuretic. And we had only a very small number of patients who were removed from the study because they had side effects that were not bearable. So it is very well tolerated. And if side effects occur, they can be managed, you know, quite easily. And doctors, GPs, physicians who deal with hypertensive patients know about these issues and can handle that you know, without specific training.
It basically showed what you were hoping it would show. What's the next step?
At this stage, so this was a phase 3 study, and phase 3, if it's positive, usually then allows the manufacturers to file a submission to the regulatory authorities. In this instance, it will be filed with the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the US. It is mainly a US company who's got the rights. And you know, they are using this study, which was clearly positive, and you know, it's very likely that this will approve, but it takes some time. That's always the drawback with these studies.
Of course, yeah.
You know, our patients we had here, they were very happy, very satisfied. But once the study finishes, of course, the drug is not available currently here. So we only will have them at our shores in a few years, unfortunately. But we will try to push to make sure it's available as soon as feasible. But, you know, this regulatory process, you just have to follow through and a lot of paperwork, but it'll come.
One of the things that interested me was you said in the lead-in or the run-in period to the study, you put all the patients, all the participants onto a poly pill.
Correct.
That clearly, in the majority of cases, had a positive effect, yes?
Absolutely. And we know about this. And this was the reason, you know, we anticipated that we would get criticism if we wouldn't try our very best to control them in the first place. So, you know, people came to us, they may have been on five different drugs, let's say, and that may not have been the best drugs to start off with. So you could criticize, well, you know, if you just had juggled around with the medication, you would have controlled those patients. So we came up with the idea, we'll stop their background medication. We put all patients on the three drugs that are recommended by the guidelines and as the top three at the maximum dose they tolerate in a single pill, which has been shown to be more effective and improve adherence. So we gave them the best chance to get away from the study, if you wish.
Yes, and, yes.
but if they still were uncontrolled and they were truly resistant hypertensives, and we confirmed that with a 24-hour blood pressure monitor as well, then they entered the study. So I think the beauty is we have really tried as hard as you can to ensure that you know, traditional medications didn't quite do the job. Yet, on top of that, with this new drug, we saw significant and clinically relevant blood pressure lowering. So that's really a bit of a game changer.
The endothelin blocker that you used in the study, is that a drug that's already being used for other conditions?
No, it's not. So this is a completely newly designed drug specifically for that purpose, taking into account previous experience with there's a number of other molecules that have been developed. But this is really the first of its kind in the context of resistant hypertension that has you know, shown substantial benefit in a phase three study. So this is really a new horizon there.
Yeah, it's exciting stuff. Given that it's going to be a couple of years before the drug gets through its regulatory process, and if I'm a GP with a hypertensive patient who's not responding to the usual things, what do I do next?
Well, look, we do have recommendations in terms of what usually works well. And there has been excellent studies. One was the so-called Pathway 2 study, which essentially established a medication called spironolactone, the preferred fourth line. Yeah, it certainly works. It's a good drug. It targets, again, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Problem is, and I mentioned earlier, you know, often it's patients with chronic kidney disease who have high, this resistant hypertension. The drug is a bit to be very cautious with that medication in those populations. So it works, but you have to monitor patients, and it's not a very well tolerated drug in the long term. I have a lot of experience with it. We use it frequently because we see a lot of these patients, and it works, no doubt. But we need more and potentially better drugs to target these highly specific cohorts that may benefit substantially from targeting the endothelin system.
So if I'm a GP, I think about spironolactone, do I put them on a poly pill?
I definitely would. I'm a great fan of it. And if I were a patient, we just had an audit of my clinic here at Royal Perth Hospital. The average number of pills is 13 and a half pills my patients are on. And these are, you know, four or five blood pressure lowering, a lipid lowering, a few anti-diabetic medications, an aspirin, whatnot. And, you know, imagine you need to take 13 tablets every single day. Like you run out of one medication, you forget to bring it in, you know, no wonder that people may not be always adherent with it. So if we can reduce the pill burden by prescribing a polypill or a single pill combination, as we call it, that will help. It's not a solution of every problem, but has clearly been shown that this is a better way of doing it, hence implemented in this study. Lifestyle modification, keeping a healthy weight, you know, not drinking in excess, not to smoke, and being physically active is, you know, the cornerstone of management of all of these chronic conditions, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. You see weight loss, however it may be achieved, can have a substantial impact on blood pressure, on glucose, on cholesterol. So we should always continue to modify our lifestyle as much as we can.
Yep.
But if that is not sufficient, then we have excellent medications and also interventions, you know, to help. Perhaps one aspect which I think is, again, quite unique. So this medication lowered both systolic and diastolic blood pressure to a similar extent, which is quite unique. And we know that amongst the different ways we measure blood pressure, nighttime blood pressure has been shown to be the best predictor of outcomes. Usually, you know, when you sleep, your blood pressure should be low because you're resting. But you imagine if you sleep for 8 hours and the pressure is constantly pushing your arteries, that is likely to cause more problems down the track. What we've seen is that with 24-hour blood pressure monitoring, this new drug had a tremendous impact on nighttime blood pressure. Although we haven't shown that, you would speculate that this will further reduce the risk for these patients. So that is quite unique about this drug and will have to be studied further, but it's really a further additional aspect of it, which makes us quite excited.
Does that mean we should be taking our blood pressure meds, whatever they are, at night before we sleep?
Well, that has been a bit of a controversy, which has now been resolved, actually. There was a big, big study in the UK, the Time study, which clearly did demonstrate that previous findings from the Higgia trial were not reproduced. So in the Higgia trial, they gave the medication at nighttime and they reported an enormous reduction in cardiovascular risk by around 50%, which is unheard of. And this new study now shows virtually no effect. So, you know, something is not quite right in that department. But most of our drugs these days work for 24 hours. That's important. You have to cover the entire day and the night. And, you know, sometimes I do, you know, give a tablet at night if it's more convenient for the patient and, you know, for other reasons. If somebody's got sleep apnea, for example. But I guess experts would agree that in general, it does not really make a big difference whether it's in the morning or at nighttime, as long as you take it regularly and every day.
Thank you, Marcus. That's awesome. Really exciting. You must be very pleased.
No, we are. Look, I mean, you know, it's you know, a lot of studies these days, as well as those presented at American Heart, were negative or neutral. This is actually more the norm these days because we already have excellent medication available. So it becomes more difficult to show efficacy. So we are thrilled. And, you know, I think it's really a bit of a game changer and will help us to treat these patients better.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.